We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does a man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. We start off Ecclesiastes, and that's the topic sentence of Ecclesiastes, it's the second, third and fourth verses of chapter 1. The words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Very unusual book is that of Ecclesiastes. There are several commentaries out available, and we're selling some outside if you like it. One that I have not read is the Tyndale commentary, so I'll be buying a copy and read it through. Whether it's good, bad or indifferent, I haven't even started, so I don't know. But the Tyndale series of commentaries are a very good series of commentaries, and they're usually fairly careful, and I've enjoyed most of them, so I presume that will be a valuable asset for me. The other one that I have read is in the Bible Speaks Today series by Derek Kidner, on the message of Ecclesiastes, which is a very marvellous and very helpful book. It's more readable. These commentary series tend to be technical in the sense that if you've got a question, you look them up and you find the answer, and tend to be fairly unreadable. It just gets dry reading answers to question after question after question that you didn't have anyway. And so they tend to be dry reading, our commentaries, whereas these tend to be much more sermons or Bible studies on each of the sections that are much more interesting reading and entertaining. So both of those are on sale outside. That one looks fairly cheap. Now that's the USA price. I don't know what our price is. It's cheap if you go to America and buy it. Now, meaningless is one of the key words of this book. It occurs 30 times in the 12 chapters that we have. It's variously translated, sometimes vanity or futility or futile. Most commonly in the NIV though, meaningless, meaninglessness. The Hebrew word means a puff of wind, a breath, a vapour, something that's insubstantial, that's nothing, that's next to nothing, that's transitory, fleeting, it's gone as soon as it arrives, of no real consequence. And the repetitive form that you have in verse 2 is a classic Hebrew way of establishing the superlative, of rather than going the most meaningless, they will go for meaningless, meaningless, meaningless upon meaningless. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless in attempt to communicate how extreme is the view of life that is being held here. Vanity of vanities, ultimate in futility, the utterly meaningless is the character of life. It's a pessimism of life that is reflected in much modern thought and literature and drama. And in the coming days, as we go through these studies, we'll be able to pick up many of the kinds of themes of meaninglessness from the non-Christians around about us. I've discovered over the years that the non-Christians frequently understand Ecclesiastes better than Christians. For most Christians, it's one of those books of the Bible that they've never really studied. It's there, they believe in it, because they've never read it. But most non-Christians are saying, not most, but many non-Christians are saying the same kinds of things that are being said here in the book of Ecclesiastes. I was interested in browsing, in part of preparation for this series that's coming, through the kinds of books. And I was looking at a book by Bronowski called The Ascent of Man. I've been reading on Darwin and The Descent of Man, and so this one caught my eye. It's been sitting on my shelf for some years. It was a TV series, kind of like Carl Sagan, only a few years back in the early 70s, I think it ran on the TV, and this is the script of it. And the whole argument is totally humanistic, totally man-centred, that man has climbed himself out of the primeval sludge and we have arrived at the top of the pinnacle. But right in the second last page, he says, "And I am infinitely saddened to find myself suddenly surrounded in the West by a sense of terrible loss of nerve, a retreat from knowledge into what? having written a book, done a TV series, all to establish how man has reached the pinnacle he reaches at the end is, we've got nowhere. We're actually moving back from it now. It looks like we're turning aside. Back into ignorance. Oz Guinness wrote an interesting book in the middle of the 70s called The Dust of Death. And he said that humanism has as principles optimism. Life is good and getting better. I'm sure that's the case. We'll see it coming out. And he said that at the moment, though, humanism is failing. And indeed, the humanist society is fairly well collapsed. But humanism is failing, he says, because there are 10 pressure points which have persuaded modern man to be pessimistic rather than optimistic. And then he rattles out what these 10 are. And for what they're worth, I think they show you the problem. The continuance of war, disease and famine is the first one. It's very hard to continue to read the newspaper about the present state of the world and continue to be optimistic. It's very hard to be a historian and be optimistic. We don't seem to be overcoming war, disease and famine. Second one is the population crash. We do seem to be able to populate more and more and more, but where does the limit come? What is going to happen? How are we ever going to cope with it? The third one that runs with it too, of course, is ecology. That much of our advance in technology, much of our capacity for feeding our greater population lies in making more and more of a ecological disaster on the planet. The fourth one is the whole question of genetic engineering and the race and the warfare and the fear of what may happen when people without any morality are able to interfere with the very genetic composition of the universe. The fifth one has got to do with an anti-scientism, which is the kind of one that Bronowski points out, that people have actually become massively disillusioned with science as a way forward, and that picks in the sixth one, is the tyranny of technology, that we create the computer, which suddenly seems to run our affairs rather than be run by us. And that is only a tiny bit of it. We create the bombs. Why we create things to destroy ourselves is one of the flaws of our characteristic. But the more we're at war, the better our technology. It's good for technology. If you're an engineer, pray for war. Just like if you're a social worker, pray for the Labour Party. There's certain kinds of social fabric which will give rise to greater and the tyranny of technology. The seventh one is the shortage of time. The idealistic optimism of humanism came out of the 19th century and the early 20th century, where we could think that it's taken thousands, millions of years for us to evolve into the state that we are, and now that we're here, we can, over the next 300-400 years, reorganise society in such a fashion that we will all live in justice and peace in the American way, with the utopia and etc. But of course, the faster our society moves, the more and more we're conscious that we don't have 300 or 400 years. We may not have another decade in which to organise everything, and it's not happening. And the eighth one he's working on is the whole moral vacuum. It's not so much that Christianity has been set aside, nothing has been put in its place. And tie that in with the technology one, and the ninth one I'll come to in a moment, you'll see terrible problems. Of course, if we can do something, we're now committed to the fact that we must do it. And the whole investigations in embryology, the whole question of the IVF program, the whole question of what we now can do, should we do, without a morality of any kind, without an agreement of morality, we are now doing the very kinds of experiments that we used to say that the Nazis were very bad for doing only 30, 40 years ago. The kind of moral justification we had for the Second World War, why, we're doing the same things ourselves now. And just because we're able to, and we've got the same moral vacuum that Nazism was able to use. And the ninth one is the vested interests. It doesn't matter how many social revolutions and economic revolutions, political revolutions, military revolutions, the same vested interests still wind up with the money in the bank. They may change political sides, but they're still that little group. And the tenth one he picks on is an increasing lack of purpose. That especially in the groups that rule in the Western world, we don't know where we're going anymore. We have no great plan, no great scheme, no great hope. We've arrived and don't know what to do. Meaninglessness. In our world, the pessimism of our world is reflected in Ecclesiastes. And in our study of it, what it'll do is two things. It'll strip away the false pride of the secularist. All the things that you think in this secularist world is worth achieving, Ecclesiastes keeps poking fun at. And for those of us who are Christians, it will keep on driving us back to the bedrock foundations, because it takes away the alternative gods and idols that have distracted us from our Christian life, just as it exposes their frailty, their foibles, and the stupidity of serving them. The preacher's question of verse 3 is, what is the profit under the sun? What is the gain? It's one of his favourite words again. It's a commercial world. You know, what is the excess of income over expenditure? What are you going to get at the end of the day as a result of certain efforts? And he says, under the sun, there is no profit. Under the sun is a key phrase. Verses 2 and 3, we're going to take a long time. Other studies, we're going to whip through chapters. So just take 2 and 3 carefully, because it's the topic sentence of the whole book. Under the sun is a phrase that comes 29 times in the book. And it means, as best I can understand it, it means life in this world without God. It's like we use the word natural as opposed to supernatural. Dispense with supernatural, dispense with God, dispense with anything that's above the sun, and what does life look like if you're only allowed to view it from the point of view of under the sun? In other words, the University of New South Wales, except for campus Bible study. What is life under the sun? And he says, under the sun there is no profit in life. It's meaningless. The balance sheet of life, there is no dividend to distribute. It's like Jesus when he says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? If you've got nothing else but this world, what is it that you've got? What profit have you got? What gain have you got? It's profitless. And the first argument of its profitlessness lies in the transitory cyclical nature of life itself. Unlike Jesus, who is using death and personal death as his argument, Ecclesiastes will do that in due time, he starts off arguing about the cyclical nature of life itself. That human generations come, human generations go, but all is forgotten. Verse 4, generations come, generation goes, but the earth remains. That's the character of life. It goes nowhere. It's like a stage, it's like this lecture theatre. This lecture theatre is built so that people can hear other people talk, so that lectures can be conducted. Thousands and thousands of lectures are conducted. Millions of lectures may be conducted. But in the end, lectures come, lectures go, the only thing that remains is the lecture theatre. And it was here for the sake of the lectures, but the lectures are insubstantial. The lectures are like a puff of wind. The lectures are vapid. They're nothing in the end. It all comes and goes, and what effect does it have? The whole world is like a stage with the scenery all there, cluttered around. You know, like old stages in theatres. They're all full of junk, stages and theatres. And that's what the world is like. It's full of the junk of life. But the life has gone, it's passed on, and no one can remember the play anymore. No one can remember who was in it. No one can remember what the storyline was, how it resolved, when it was conducted, because it just comes and goes and comes and goes, and the only thing that's left is, it's like down Port Hacking, where I've wandered along the foreshore there. Every now and then you come to an old boat shed that's semi-destroyed. You know, somebody, sometime, somewhere back there, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 20 years ago, built the thing for their boat. And they had fun building it, and they had fun putting their boat in it and taking it out and putting it back and cleaning it, because you always got to clean those wretched things. And they had fun in it, but now there is just the testimonial to the fact that somebody some other time enjoyed being there. But they're gone, there's no memory of them, they may be dead, their boat's sunk, and it really doesn't matter anymore. Life is like that, it actually is in the long run going nowhere. Indeed, that's the way of the world, verse 5. The sun rises, the sun sets, hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south, turns to the north, round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. So the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. See, even the earth itself is a meaningless thing. It's a vast universe that is actually going nowhere. And it's like Halley's Comet, which so set us alight a couple of years ago, those of us who are silly enough to get up in the middle of the night to wander around looking for it. Here is something. This is a once-in-a-lifetime experience for you, because you're too old to get it in 70 years' time again. But Halley's Comet is a nothing. It's going on this great trip around and round nowhere. I mean, there it is, but if you stand here 70 years' time, it'll be there again and again and again and again, because it's just going in circles or ellipses. It's just going around and around. It's like Life is like an experimental rat running on a wheel. Enormous energy is being expended for nothing, except somebody's PhD, of course. All of it is for nothing. The whole universe, what is the end goal of it all? Entropy. The end goal is nothingness. And so it's all wearisomeness, as he says in verse 8. It's all just wearisome. It's like a child throwing sand into the sea. It never achieves anything. Never gets anywhere. It's just a waste of energy. And the cyclical view of nature spills over into the very human existence. It says, you and I are nowhere. We're going, but we're going nowhere. We're not making it to anywhere. Verse 8. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing. The ear never its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything which anyone can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. There's no remembrance of men of old, that even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. There's nothing new under the sun. It's always been, it's always going, it's always moving, but never arriving, never achieving. It's like the grand old Duke of York who marched his men up the hill to march them down again. Or if you're a little bit more sophisticated than that, it's like the myth of Sisyphus, who's ever caught up in rolling the boulder up to the top of the hill, which rolls back down again. It actually is going nowhere. And that ancient myth of Sisyphus, of course, is taken up by the modern writer Camus in his book called The Myth of Sisyphus, which really is a discussion of suicide, because maybe suicide is the one thing that I can do which is a something, because everything else I do is really just nothing. It's just rolling the boulder up the hill to roll down again. It's just Duke of York country. But as you hear it, you're starting to say, but hang on, Philip, there are things that are new. We have made achievements. We have arrived at things. I mean, there are things that are new and therefore meaningful. Is there? Every night on the ABC we have 15 minutes of radio news, 30 minutes of television news. It's extraordinary, of course, that we can always have 15 exact minutes of it. You know, there's never a day in which so much happens that you've got to have 17 minutes. Or so little happens that you've only got to have 6 minutes. Right? You've always got to have exactly 15 minutes. Why? Because nothing ever happens. That's why. If one day they should put on the news yesterday's tape, would you notice? I would suspect not. It's the same every day, isn't it? I mean, you change the locations, you change the names, but somebody got killed, somebody got run over, there was a hijacking somewhere, there was a bomb somewhere, it's always the same. I read most of the way through a newspaper once that was 3 months old. I couldn't work out why this politician who had been dismissed kept on reappearing in power. I thought, I must have missed something last week, that he'd been reinstated or something. And then finally I saw the date and discovered I'd been reading a paper that was 3 months old. It was just like today's. It was as good as. I think you can save a lot of money if you hang on to your old newspapers and just keep reading them over and over again. Nothing is new in the news. Ever read the Guinness Book of Records? It's a marvellous exhibition, isn't it, of all the stupidity that humans can get up to, of all the great achievements. But of course, every year it has to be replaced because someone makes a further achievement. You know, they knock over three more dominoes. They are able to eat four more bananas or whatever it may be. That is the great new achievement of mankind that must be recorded in the 1974 edition, because that's better than the 1973. But cynicism and humour aside, what about walking on the moon? I mean, surely that's a new thing. Well, in one sense it is, but in another sense it's not. It's not much different to Captain Cook walking on the land out here. It's the great discovery that took a year or so to go, and when we got there we found that it was a barren waste, as he did too. I mean, it really isn't all that great. In fact, do you remember the names of the three men who were there? Or how many ships actually went to the moon in that series of trips that went to the moon? Do you remember what the series of experiments were called? One of the men who worked on it, I heard on the ABC Science Show, totally disillusioned because he says no one can remember what we did and who we were. In fact, what change in your understanding of life has come about as a result of someone having walked on the moon 20 years ago? What What do you actually know? What do you feel? What change in the way you live has happened as a result of that great event? I think for most of us, absolutely nothing. Oh, we might now, because they expended such money on such high-tech stuff, we may have cleverer watches or something like that, but it really has made no significant difference that it's happened. No, there's nothing new. Memories are very short, he says. The desire for novelty is great, enormous. I always want to know what's happening. But the memory is very short. The achievements are little. And there's a real lack of historical perspective, which makes us very impressed by recent modern culture and quite unimpressed by things in the ancient past. Ignorant of them, really. See, some years ago, a man called Eric von Däniken made a fortune out of conning people into thinking that spacemen came and visited the world many, many years ago, because he says the primitive people of the ancient past were able to do miraculously technological things like build pyramids and make the statues on Easter Islands and he gave all these lists of all the great achievements of ancient man and says, how could primitives do such a thing? And lots of people bought his books and bought his ideas because they knew absolutely nothing about ancient history. And they had this terrible arrogance of believing that only modern people are clever. Ancient people are every bit as clever as modern people. Have you ever looked at their technology? They did very clever things back then. Not because of spacemen, but because they did them. But we have forgotten. That's what he says here, you see. What's happened in the past? Well, there's no remembrance of the men of old. We don't know about that. And us, will we be remembered? Who was Mr. Matthews? Well, he was sitting in his lecture theatre. He was significant and important enough to name a whole series of lecture theatres after him and a great big monolithic structure over there with lifts that do and do not work. But who was he? What did he do? Is he still alive? He must have achieved something, but someone's called him that. And do you think the next generation's going to remember even more than we have? Well, it depends if they read the little sign on one of the buildings that's here. See the photograph, but most of us don't even know, do we? Hands up those who are confident they know who he is. Was? And there you go, you see. Buildings named after him. He must have been important, mustn't he? Or wealthy. But we don't even remember. That's what it says here. And you, do you think you're going to be remembered in successive generations? Think again, friends. Generations come, generations go, and the end financial result is nothing. It's meaningless. So our author goes on a search for meaning. He goes adopting the role of Solomon, the wisest of the richest of the kings of Jerusalem, and he explores wisdom. Verses 12 to 18. I, the teacher, who was king over Israel in Jerusalem, I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, are chasing after wind. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learnt that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Here's his inquiry. He starts out with wisdom. It's part of wisdom literature, this book, and that's where he should start. But he warns you from the beginning that it's doomed. The wisdom under heaven, the wisdom given by God, not under the sun, but given by God, is a heavy burden for man, because it's incapable of really changing anything. You see, it is God who has given us this wisdom, he is saying there in verse 13. It's a heavy burden given. We are thinking creatures because of God. But our thinking alone will lead to no answers. And so therefore it's a very heavy burden. We have been given the eyes sufficient to see, but we haven't been given enough light to see. And so we know that there is such a thing as sight, but we can't see anything. We know there's such a thing as wisdom and knowledge and understanding, but we aren't wise enough to know anything and so can't understand anything other than we know that we've got it. And so the warning is from the beginning, this is going to be a futile inquiry. And I warn you that now in case you build your hopes that we're going to give you great answers. The great answer is meaninglessness. That's what he says in verse 14. If you search under the sun for meaning, you'll find nothing. See, in verses 16 to 18, he tries wisdom. And he grows in wisdom more than all. He investigates folly and madness. And he learns that the whole growing in wisdom activity is a chasing after wind. It's like a little boy running across the paddocks trying to keep up with the sun. It's an energetic folly. Why? Well, because of verse 18. He says, the more you know, the more you understand, the more sorrowful you become, the more you're filled with grief, the more you understand the pain of life. The little child has not got the pain because the little child doesn't know much. But do you think by knowing much you're going to then... No, by knowing much you're going to hate life more. You see, you're conned by the evening television news. What is it going to be tonight? Which disaster are we going to have shown to us in gory detail? And some people say that the only thing they enjoy on television is the news. I'm always worried about people like that. There's a certain element of sadism in them. It seems to me any sensitive soul could never enjoy the news. Because the more you know about the world, the more you're sorrowful. The more you see your impotence of changing anything, of helping anything, the only way to enjoy life in Australia is to continue to be as ignorant as most Australians are. Never discover anything about how bad life is for the rest of mankind. Never find out about the number of children who are going to bed tonight hungry. Don't find out about it because it ruins your own meal, doesn't it? Takes the edge right off the enjoyment of that second and third helping to know that the vast slabs of humanity are actually dying out there of starvation. That would be an awful thing to happen, wouldn't it? Now, the more you know, the more your sorrow increases. And so if wisdom is going to be justified by pleasure, maybe it's pleasure that he should pursue. And verses 1 to 11 of chapter 2, he follows the problem of pleasure. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test with pleasure to find out what is good. No, but that also proved meaningless, I warned you. Laughter, I said, is foolish, and what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom, and I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under the heaven during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold and myself and treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well. The delights of the hearts of a man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work. And this is the reward for all my labour. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. He chases after pleasure. The drunken revelry of verse 4, the aesthetic achievements of verses 4 to 9. All the time still thinking, so he doesn't lose his marbles, he's not so blotto in the brain that he can't work out what the party's about. But what is the wisdom? What wisdom do you find in wine? What wisdom do you find in getting drunk? Absolutely none, of course. There's no one who's more dehumanised than the drunk as he vomits. The party is a very short-lived, an unnatural and a hopeless way of finding out what life's about, and always carries with it the sickness and the hangover. Aesthetics may be a more honourable form of pleasure seeking, but there's no limit to what he did. But all the time the fun came in the pursuit, never in the achievement. It's like that, isn't it? Winning the cup was really fun, but now that you've got the cup, you've got to dust it all the time. And it's awfully boring having cups on your mantelpiece. You may not know that, I'm sorry that you've never won one, but it's like the school trophy cabinet. There is no more boring object in the place, is there? It just sits there. All the fun lies in achieving and acquiring, but the acquisition itself brings you no pleasure. It's called midlife crisis. But you'll see it in people. Your parents may be going through it even. For having struggled for 20, 30 years to climb the ladder, to achieve, to succeed, to make it, when they finally get there with their two houses and their trips overseas and their boats and all the rest, when they finally get it all, they are massively, unutterably bored out of their brains. All the fun lay in getting it. But it brought no fun to them in the end. Lovely people. Living in a very paltry, humdrum existence is the character of Australia. He said, pleasure's not like that. Pursue pleasure, find none. So he said, I'll pursue wisdom. Back to that in verses 12 to 16. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. Whoops, verse 12. Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can a king's successor do than has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head while the fool walks in darkness. But I came to realise that the same fate overtakes them both. And then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. And then what do I gain by being wise? And I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In the days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man must too die. So the second pursuit of wisdom and of the opposite of folly and stupidity is no better than the first. I mean, it's obvious, he says, that wisdom is better than folly. Just like it's obvious that to have sight is better than to be blind. I mean, that's obvious. But the fate of the wise and the fate of the fool is the same. Death and obscurity. Neither escape the grave, neither will be remembered down the track. And so at the end of the financial year, which gives dividends, which gives profits? Neither. They both just give crematorium fodder. The wise man, he gives no profit. The fool, it's the same. There's no profit under the sun. It's like that, friends. You can work and strain and struggle and strive and get yourself all the knowledge in the world, but you're only going to die. And who's going to take attention to it? And what is achieved by it? I'll give you a... Neither escape the grave, neither will be remembered down the track. And so at the end of the financial year, which gives dividends, which gives profits? Neither. They both just give crematorium fodder. The wise man, he gives no profit. The fool, it's the same. There's no profit under the sun. It's like that, friends. You can work and strain and struggle and strive and get yourself all the knowledge in the world, but you're only going to die. And who's going to take attention to it? And what is achieved by it? I'll give you a living, a couple of living examples, very sad ones. I've got two friends. One got a doctorate from Oxford University in history. His family didn't know what Oxford was. Illiterate and uneducated people. They didn't know that Oxford University was a kind of a university. I mean, they couldn't understand why he had to go to Oxford, over to England to go to university. I mean, what was wrong with the universities in Australia? Well, you may say nothing. They certainly didn't understand what a doctorate was because they couldn't work out how he could be a doctor and not operate on people or how studying history would equip him to be able to operate on people. I'm glad to say that he has got it quite clear that just because he's got a doctorate in history, he's not going to open up a surgery. But his parents have never understood what that was about as to why he's a doctor but he doesn't do any medical work. It's all meaningless to them. One of our friends here at Campus Bible Study won the University Medal a few years ago here in this campus. His parents didn't come to the graduation because they didn't understand what a graduation was. And they couldn't understand how he won a medal because he was not very athletic. What do you achieve in life, you see? What have you got with all your wisdom and all your knowledge? More knowledge, more grief, more sorrow. In the end, death. Einstein's dead, Newton's dead, Shakespeare's dead. And their books are selling cheap at the book sale. In the end, your book will be worth 5 cents on a second-hand book fair. Not that the person who buys it reads it. No, no, they'll photocopy it. And so he says, I hate life. Getting all the wisdom in the world has achieved for me a very big plaque on my crematorium wall. Or alternatively, a standard size plaque with very little writing because I've got so many degrees to fit on. But no one's going to remember. No one's going to turn up and read it. You do not know who Mr. Matthews was. Who cares? That's you too, isn't it? In 100 years' time, they'll say exactly the same for you. That's if you ever made it to the stage where they built a building and named it after you. Most of us, we won't even get the building, will we? And so, hating life, he makes one more attempt. Material pursuit. Verse 17, now I've got it right. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it's meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated the things that I toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the work into which I've poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labour under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. That too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for all his toil and anxious striving with which he labours under the sun? All his days his work is pain and grief, and even at night his mind doesn't rest. It's meaningless. It's all empty, you see. It's left to another. Whoever inherits my wealth, my books, my possessions, my writings, whoever, they own my life. And they, of course, may be a greater fool than me. I may leave everything to a fool who will waste the lot. I must leave everything to a fool who will destroy the lot. It's like pouring all your life into painting one great canvas. Inch by inch, millimetre by millimetre, you layer a layer of oils onto this magnificent canvas that at the end of 30, 40 years, there's your life's work. It may not be great even, but it's you. It's everything that you have ever done is there. And so you die. And it's left to someone who doesn't give a fig for art, who sells it off to a kindergarten so the children can paint and do finger painting over the top of it. That is what your life is worth. Because you must leave it to another who is a fool, your life is worth nothing. Do you think you can secure your life against total abuse by your heirs? Think again, friends. It's all emptiness. And so what am I working for? What am I gathering for? What am I amassing and acquiring more for my kids? Well, they can be the greatest fools of all, especially if they never meet with their father because he's always out getting more money. The kids frequently don't appreciate the work and the value. The kids frequently, of course, the children of materialists are frequently anti-materialists, dropping out and living in Nimbin off the fat of the lean or the earth or eating that dreadful, never mind. But they don't appreciate what you've done for them. Is that not what your parents are saying for you at the moment? Don't you appreciate all the hours we've worked for you, how much we've laboured for you? It's all been for you. Now get in there and study, so that you can do it for your children and stand over them and browbeat them, so that they can do it for their children and theirs and theirs and theirs. So where's it ending? Where's it going to? All that wake, all that work, you see that pain of verse 23, even at night. And of course, those of us who are thoroughgoing materialists, it's right, isn't it? At night you're awake worried about it. One of my friends, an elderly man who's worked all his life and has acquired a nice little income, a nice little nest egg to leave to his kids. And his whole retirement is filled up with the anxiety of not wanting inflation and all the rest of it to destroy it before he dies. I mean, he wants to die quickly so that he can leave enough on to his family, because he's worried all the time about what's happening to it. It's awful. And so the author concludes in verses 24 to 26, the first cycle of arguments. They're all cycles. We're not going to make much progress here, friends, because life's meaningless, you see. There's naught else, he says, to eat and drink and be satisfied, verse 24. What can a man do? Sorry, a man can do nothing better than eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. And this too I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat and find any enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge and happiness, but to the sinner he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to one who pleases God. And this too is meaningless. A chasing after the sun, after the wind. There's two categories, you see. You can live under God or you can live under the sun. If you find life under God, you will find enjoyment in what you eat and what you work. It's God who gives meaning and enjoyment to life. But without God, without a point of reference outside of the world, there is no meaning. There is no purpose. If you serve God, you will be given wisdom and knowledge and happiness. If you serve yourself, you will find none of those things. That is, if you look for pleasure, you will never find it. It will always be the next party, the next weekend. You'll never get there. If you look for God, you will find pleasure where you are. Because the point of reference has to be outside of you. Life under the sun, man outside of God, always lives in dissatisfaction. Materialism is always unsatisfying. You gather and gather and gather, only to give it away to another. Life under the sun is fundamentally meaningless. It's a depressing tale. But stop and think about the two categories you have here. There are people here now who are living under the sun. That is, living without God. They keep finding that life is meaningful because God gives us the wisdom to see it's meaningful. But they keep finding that they can't find the meaning. I know there is a meaning somewhere. I just don't know what it is. And so they keep looking, like this man, in higher education. But the more you go on, you'll find the more and more people telling you that they don't know. Or they look for it in pleasure, but you never actually find it. Or they look for it in the acquisition of wealth, but it always is disillusioning and unsatisfying. Life without God is meaningless. But secondly, there are those who live under God. And if we live under God, you see what Ecclesiastes does for it? It strips away the alternatives that we still carry in our system. For although I live under God, I still think my life will find meaning in pleasure, or my life will find meaning in wisdom, or my life will find meaning in material acquisitions. And what it's saying is, no, if you're going to live under God, it's God who gives meaning to wisdom, to pleasure, to acquisition. If you're going to live under God, then you must live under God. For much of the frustrations and disappointments of Christian experience is living the lie. I accept that life is under God, but I still want to live under the sun. And so I do not find the satisfactions that come from living under God. Over and again, people will see, don't want to live under anyone. They want to live over everything. They want to live as God, running their own events. But the only meaning that is then available is the meaning you make up. And the meaning you make up is a lie. Because it's not out there. There's no objectivity to it. There is just how you feel. And you don't know if you're not psychiatric. Without God, there is no meaning. Let's pray. Father, as we start to tackle this most unusual part of your word, we pray that you would help us not to shy away from these hard questions and these depressing viewpoints of life and the pessimism that rages through this, but to face up to the horror of life without you in its full consequences. Help us, Father, those of us who do not know you as our Father, help us to face the full consequences of trying to live without you and not to pretend. Help us, Father, those who know you as Father, not to be distracted by a life outside of you, but to see the reality that life can only find its satisfaction and meaning and purpose in you. Help us as we study this book to deal with it honestly, to deal with you honestly, to deal with ourselves honestly. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.